Tanto Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents A Meaning to Life by Michael Ruse, narrated by John Lee. Remember, friend, as you pass by, as you are now, so once was I, as I am now, so you shall be. Prepare for death and follow me. Preface. This book is the end of a journey. For all that I have just quoted an uncomfortable epitaph that I saw once in a church in Norfolk in England, that sounds a little more sepulchral than I intend. It is true that I am approaching 80, 10 after my biblically allotted span. Although what I am saying is obviously connected to that, I am referring mainly to my academic career. The child is the father of the man. I was raised as a Christian, very intensely as a Quaker, with great stress not only on the moral duties of life, but also on the mystical nature of the Godhead and of our encounter with it. Also, given that there are no creeds or dogmas, with the strong belief that one must work things out for oneself, as I did. Around the age of 20, my faith faded, never to return. It would be easy to say that it was a direct function of starting into a life as a professional philosopher, reading Hume's dialogues, and that sort of thing. Just not true, I am afraid. Natural theology was never a big part of my youth, and it is not now. I was a Kierkegaardian before I had even heard of Denmark. It was rather like baked beans and stamp collecting, two other great passions of my childhood. I just grew out of them. I did take up girls, which somewhat compensated. My non-existent God was not about to give up that easily. I have a nasty feeling that he is a bit of a Calvinist, who doesn't believe too strongly in the virtues of human free will. As I got underway as someone with a research agenda, I found that the issue of science and religion was always there to intrigue and excite me. In major part, this was because I became a historian and philosopher of science, specializing in Charles Darwin's theory of evolution, past and present. As you can infer from this book, it was my love of Victorian culture that led me this way. I will never forget, as a late teenager, standing on the summit of Parliament Hill Fields, at the southern tip of Hampstead Heath, and looking down across London, marvelling at that wonderful 19th-century structure, St. Pancras Railway Station. Darwin and his ideas were unnatural, and it is hard to stay away from science and religion issues if this is the focus of your research. Factors from outside were also important. I got very much involved in the fight against the introduction of creationism in schools. This led me to the federal courthouse in Little Rock, Arkansas, where I was a witness for the American Civil Liberties Union, speaking on the natures of science and religion, Darwinian theory, and creationism. Fighting alongside such people as paleontologist and popular science writer Stephen Jay Gould and America's leading Protestant theologian Langdon Gilkey was both a great responsibility and a great privilege. It was also, for someone with a personality like mine, great fun. I was writing, and I continue to write on these topics as I still do. In recent years, I have felt more freedom to explore avenues that interest me. I am a full professor with tenure. I am not about to move. I have had all the fancy fellowships that one could get or could want to get, and given that I am still working, my pension is in pretty good shape. I have gone in directions that upset many of my fellow Darwinians, most particularly looking at the similarities between our position and that of our opponents, Christians, often of the more evangelical kind. I am indeed rather proud of the fact that I have been called a clueless gobshite, and that, in the God delusion, Richard Dawkins advised reporters always to check with someone else after they have talked to me. Jerry Coyne, the University of Chicago evolutionist, tells his readers that George Orwell was right. Only an intellectual could believe the nonsense I propound. Here, however, I do not want to talk of past triumphs. I will leave finding the sources for these comments as an exercise for the reader, but you might start with the somewhat overheated blog run by Coyne, Why Evolution is True. For some time now, I have sensed that I wanted to write not so much a synthesis, but a capstone, something that emerges in its own right from work that I have done. something that asks whether the rather detailed and often inward-looking research to which I have devoted the scholarly part of my life, I never forget that my main role in life has been as a teacher, can speak to those ultimate existential questions about the meaning of life, those questions that were so very important to me as a child. Perhaps that fading was more apparent than real. Truly, I still have a sneaking love of baked beans. Has my scholarly career been worth it? Has it taken my understanding forward? Do I have something to offer to others? My answers are here in this book. My approach is often more personal than one expects in a book by a professional philosopher. I told you that I have reached the stage in my life where I feel more freedom. There is hardly a page where I have not drawn, often extensively, on previous writings, which is one excuse, I suppose, for so many self-references. Although I am rather rude about some ways in which the notion of emergence is employed, this book is, in a very real sense, emergent. It comes from the past, but what emerges is here in the present, and it is new, not of the past. In a way, therefore, and this pleases me immensely, my book is truly evolutionary. In our physical structure, in our behavior, in just about every thought we have, we humans show our past. We are something new and novel and unique. Are we better than the past? Is this book better than anything I have written before? That is for you to decide. You will find much in this book that is pertinent to these questions. Introduction. You are born, you live, then you die. It's terrifying. If you don't think so, then you should. We came from an eternity of oblivion. We return to an eternity of oblivion. In between, we try to make sense of it all and to lead worthwhile lives. In the end, you know truly that it doesn't mean a thing. Shakespeare, in Macbeth, is good on this. And all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death. Out, out, brief candle. Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage, and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. The great 18th-century Scottish philosopher David Hume was the arch-skeptic. His delving into the nature of knowledge led him to the conclusion that there is no absolute support for anything. We think the sun will rise tomorrow, but, as Bertrand Russell was to say sardonically, we could be in the state of the turkey on Christmas Eve. We expect that nice farmer to come along with a bucket of feed. Oh, what's this? Why is he carrying an axe instead? Fortunately, said Hume, our psychology protects us from the hole into which philosophy has pitched us. I dine, I play a game of backgammon, I converse, and am merry with my friends. And when, after 3 or 4 hours' amusement, I would return to these speculations, they appear so cold and strained and ridiculous that I cannot find in my heart to enter into them any farther. Are we not in the same place with respect to our worries about meaning and what we might call the ultimate questions? If we think about it, if we use our reason, then we have no answers. To say it again, it is terrifying. Tolstoy had it right. Everything we do and say ends as stench and worms. Obviously, though, we couldn't go through life, we couldn't function as organisms, if this reality was ever before us, paralyzing our will and unable to do anything. Our psychology must and does rescue us. My wife and I take the kids to the seaside. It's fun. The children have a good time. My wife and I have the added satisfaction of working as a team, making for a functioning and healthy family. At one level, obviously, it is all part of biology. More little ruses coming into the gene pool to ensure the future. This does not deny that at another level, it all makes good sense, with lots of meaning and purpose. A day out like this is as far from signifying nothing as it is possible to be. We know what signifying nothing is all about. It is a day spent at home, vegging out, non-stop watching television of the lowest denominator. The soaps and news programs about dear leaders. Fair enough. But let's not kid ourselves. In the end, the problems of us little people don't amount to a hill of beans in this crazy world. The American pragmatist philosopher William James knew the score, admitting that we are all such helpless failures in the last resort. He laments the fact that the sanest and best of us are of one clay with lunatics and prison inmates, and death finally runs the robustest of us down. No wonder, then, that after reflections like these, such a sense of the vanity and provisionality of our voluntary career comes over us that all our morality appears but as a plaster, hiding a sore it can never cure, and all our well-doing as the hollowest substitute for that well-being that our lives ought to be grounded in, but, alas, are not. The only consolation we have is, as the little epitaph told us, we are all in it together. No one is going to escape. Not the President, not the Queen, not the Dean of Arts and Sciences. We are all going to die, and with death come darkness, stillness, nothing. Close this book before we start. Well, not quite so fast. Many wise and sensible, decent people, in the past and still in the present, think we are ignoring the crucial element in the story. Life is not meaningless, as we have been suggesting. It all makes very good sense, in general and in particular, for us. You simply have to accept that there is a creator, an intelligent force, a God behind all of this. William James, having dug the hole, now fills it. Here religion comes to our rescue and takes our fate into her hands. This fills us with joy. What we most dreaded has become the habitation of our safety, and the hour of our moral death has turned into our spiritual birthday. The time for tension in our soul is over, and that of happy relaxation, of calm, deep breathing, of an eternal present, with no discordant future to be anxious about, has arrived. Fear is not held in abeyance as it is by mere morality. It is positively expunged and washed away. For people in the Abrahamic traditions, this supposed deity is not just any old god. It is God, Yahweh, Jehovah, the God of the Old Testament, which made heaven and earth, the sea and all that therein is, which keepeth truth forever. Psalm 146, verse 6. For the Christian, there is Jesus the Messiah, who died on the cross for our eternal salvation. Those writing on the meaning of life stress again and again that this God is the way and the only way. In the words of the Protestant writer William Lane Craig, if there is no God, the world is the result of a cosmic accident, a chance explosion. There is no reason for which it exists. As for man, he is a freak of nature, a blind product of matter plus time plus chance. Man is just a lump of slime that evolved into rationality. What exactly is this God that gives our lives such meaning, and what is our place in that equation? As we philosophers like to say, obviously a lot is going to depend on what you mean by meaning. We'll be working on this one through the whole book. For now, let us agree that it is something of value, of worth, to be desired. I'm not sure that there is an identity. Is everything of value that meaningful? A game of golf. Is everything meaningful that valuable? Adolf Hitler? But we can surely say that the Christian horror at the alternative, nihilistic alternative, there is nothing, is bound up with value. The alternative means that nothing we do has any value or worth. Shakespeare was right about us just being walking shadows. What then is the value in or from God? His very being, for a start. He is perfect, without cause, totally good, all-knowing, and all-powerful. If this is not what we mean by valuable and meaningful, then what is? We humans get our meaning and value from the fact that we are created by this God, out of love, for him to cherish and for us to adore and obey him. Christians, of course, have their own particular take on all of this. We were created perfect, but then we fell, and God himself had to sacrifice on the cross. But in so doing, he put things back together again, and we can again continue eternally in our symbiotic relationship with our Creator. If you put things this way, it all seems pretty cut and dried. Given the comforts of Christianity, who but a total fool or lunatic would opt for anything else? Why would you belike the unfortunate clergyman, Mr. Prendergast, in Evelyn Waugh's Decline and Fall, and have doubts? If you do have them, then why not follow the advice of Pascal and push them down? After all, if there is something, you win, and if there is nothing, you hardly lose. In any case, if you try hard enough at believing, you may end up believing after all. And yet people do. Have doubts, that is. Actually, not so much doubts as absolute convictions that what you see is what you get, and it isn't necessarily all that nice or meaningful in any sense of the word. The 19th-century German philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer was good on this sort of thing. Here is a characteristically paragraph-long sentence on the topic. If you try to imagine, as nearly as you can, what an amount of misery, pain, and suffering of every kind the sun shines upon in its course, you will admit that it would be much better if, on the earth, as little as on the moon, the sun were able to call forth the phenomena of life, and if, here as there, the surface were still in a crystalline state. Warming to his theme and turning to us humans, if children were brought into the world by an act of pure reason alone, would the human race continue to exist? Would not a man rather have so much sympathy with the coming generation as to spare it the burden of existence, or at any rate not take it upon himself to impose that burden upon it in cold blood? Schopenhauer had his 20th-century counterparts. There was the French existentialist Albert Camus, for instance, assuring us that there is but one truly serious philosophical question, and that is suicide. Existence is absurd. We are in the position of Sisyphus, forever rolling the rock up the hill, only to have it roll back down and having to start again. It is legitimate to wonder, clearly and without false pathos, whether a conclusion of this importance requires forsaking, as rapidly as possible, an incomprehensible condition. Moving on to the 21st century, the South African philosopher David Benatar can give the Germans and the French a run for their money. We are born, we live, we suffer along the way, and then we die, obliterated for the rest of eternity. What's it all about? Benatar concludes sagely and fearlessly, ultimately nothing. Continuing to the dreadful conclusion, despite some limited consolations, the human condition is in fact a tragic predicament from which none of us can escape, for the predicament consists not merely in life, but also in death. There you have the answer, and there, for me, you have the question. If life is so awful, why then do we have the Schopenhauers and Benatars of life, or, perhaps more appropriately, of existence? Why don't we all just take the God alternative, the Christian alternative, perhaps, and have done with it? Why, indeed, keep on harping about it all? Why not drop the topic and move on? Simply because that is what philosophers do, and I am a professional philosopher, and that is what I do. Say it again, Socrates. The unexamined life is not worth living. Caveat emptor. I am truly a historian of ideas, and not really that immersed in the usual analytic philosophy of today's Anglophone thinkers. Until starting the project leading to this book, I had not realized quite what a cottage industry meaning of life discussions had become. I am, to say it again, a professional, and you will understand that I take note of and use, with appreciation and gratitude, ideas from this industry. I have already started to do so. However, said he rather proudly, you will understand that I do not fit the usual pattern. My quest on the meaning of life question began independently about 20 years ago, when I was invited to give some of the Gifford lectures. Explicitly, these are intended to promote and diffuse the study of natural theology in the widest sense of the term, in other words, the knowledge of God. Hence the spark that led me here, for I am an ardent Darwinian evolutionist, and it was this that informed my lectures. I think that the implications of Charles Darwin's ideas, as given in his On the Origin of Species and The Descent of Man, are the most important things in Western thought, at least back to the Copernican Revolution. Specifically, I think the fact that we humans are the end products of the slow, law-bound process of natural selection has huge implications. Huge implications for questions about the meaning of life. You want to talk about the knowledge of God? Talk about Darwin. That was my contribution to the theme of 2001's Gifford Lectures, and that continues to be my stance today. If further justification is needed in taking up a much-discussed topic, it is that this all-important event barely, if at all, makes it into the analytic discussions of the meaning of life. To be fair, although there are many who deny Darwin's contribution, people are not creationists. They just don't think that evolution, including Darwinian evolution, is all that important. Had not the great Ludwig Wittgenstein, in his groundbreaking Tractatus, said, "Darwin's theory has no more to do with philosophy than any other hypothesis in natural science." He kept up this theme. Around 1950, not long before his death, he was still saying, "I have often thought that Darwin was wrong. His theory doesn't account for all this variety of species. It hasn't the necessary multiplicity." I am not going to argue the toss here, or try to interpret Wittgenstein's somewhat gnomic remark. Just make my own case positively. The key will be the actual scientific claim about evolution through natural selection and its application to us humans. For now, though, I want to pick up on Darwin's methodology, namely seeking information in the past to throw light on the present. For instance, about why the birds of the Galapagos Archipelago are like those of South America, and why the birds of the Canary Islands are like those of Africa. I want to start by turning to history, and what seems to me to be the biggest puzzle. A puzzle of a personal nature. I have recently edited two collections on atheism, its nature and its history. One thing that has struck me and my very nice Christian co-editor is how hard it is to find anyone to write on the Middle Ages. We just cannot seem to ferret out atheists anywhere. Everyone was in the Christian paradigm, as one might say, or a Jew or a Muslim, and there was value and meaning everywhere. Yet after that, as time goes by, our job gets easier and easier. There are God deniers everywhere, until the biggest problem is saying what we don't want included. That is where I want to start, then, with the history of the decline of God belief and the increasing willingness to embrace a nihilistic view of existence. As you might expect, toward the end of this history, Darwin's theory is going to appear. A big part of the discussion will be on the theory's nature and implications, or not, as the case may be. Against this historical background, I shall turn to philosophizing, and I shall structure the discussion on a very helpful taxonomy embraced by the analytic philosophers. First, I shall turn to theism, and see where things stand today in the light of history, in the light of Darwin. I shall avail myself of what I think is a very useful dichotomy, meaning in light of the God question, meaning in light of the human soul question. To this end, I shall supplement the discussion of Christianity, for this will be my main religion, with a brief discussion of Buddhism, which, as is well known, has a rather different take on the God question, but when it comes to us, has strong feelings about meaning. I move second to non-theism. Let us call it naturalism. And again I shall invoke an established dichotomy, this time between objective meaning or value and subjective meaning or value. I shall show that Darwin has been, still is, taken in both directions. I shall also show why, for me, the subjective route is the one to take. Yet although I am so far with the naysayers as to think of myself as a Darwinian existentialist, I shall argue that there is more to the story than Schopenhauer and his fellows allow. I am not in the suicide business. I am not sure that Camus was either, however much he seemed to enjoy wallowing in the absurdity of it all. Whatever. I am led back to Hume and what he had to say on scepticism and psychology, which will bring me happily to a very Darwin-inspired concluding meditation on how limited is our knowledge about any of it, a message that all philosophers confront at some point or another. 1. The Unraveling of Belief. Medieval Religion. I want to start in England around 1500, the end of the 15th century and the beginning of the 16th. I choose England because that was the country of my birth and my upbringing and the one whose history I know best. I am sure someone living in one of the great countries in Western Europe, France and Germany particularly, could write something similar. If you look just at the bare statistics, it all seems grim. Today, life expectancy in England is around 80 years, a bit more for women than for men, a bit more in the more prosperous south of the country than in the north. If you go back 500 years or so, however, life expectancy is less than half of that, around 35 years to be exact. That, however, is a little misleading, for up to a third of children didn't make it past the first year, and a tenth or more of women died in childbirth. If you got past these hurdles, you might make it to around 45. Of course, as today, some people lived much longer, but they were the exceptions. There is no big mystery here. As the 17th century English philosopher Thomas Hobbes said, life tended to be solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. He said it in the context of the Civil War, but it applied in peacetime too. Certainly, if you were a member of a family that was prosperous, say, a rich merchant, in a town like Norwich in East Anglia, making a fortune out of the wool trade, there were going to be compensations. These would be limited and restricted. You got breast cancer and you were doomed. The same if you fell off of your horse. That is, before you start on the various diseases and plagues. Not to put too fine a point on it all, everyone lived every day with a background stench of fecal matter, if not that of you and your family and your servants, then that of your animals. Today we use water to flush it all away. Then, as like as not, you drank the water. These were the rich and comfortable. Think of the labourer and his family in their cottage, cold, hungry, ignorant, tired all the time, dirty. The list is endless. Seemingly, Schopenhauer had a point. There was another side to it all, making, if not for an outrightly happy life, then certainly a life of meaning, one that gave positive joy and freedom to nigh everyone, prince and pauper, to use a cliché. This was religion, more particularly the Catholic version of Christianity. This had both an inward side and an external side, although truly they were one. The inward side was the traditional story of Christianity. The world and everything in it was created by a loving God. Humans had a special place. We were made in the image of God. But we fell, and hence something was needed for our eternal salvation. This could only be done by God himself, so he came to earth in the form of Jesus Christ, and through the sacrifice on the cross, all was again made possible. We can join God in heaven, but only if we behave down here on earth. To this traditional story was added a great deal of comforting detail, virtually all, as the future Protestants were to point out, without biblical support. Most obviously, there was the status and role of the Mother of Christ, the Virgin Mary. To put it candidly, the biblical evidence for this is thin to non-existent. Not all the Gospels dwell on her early experiences of giving birth to the Messiah, and sometimes the move is the other way. Who is my mother, and who are my brethren? Matthew chapter 12, verse 48. The answer comes, For whosoever shall do the will of my Father which is in heaven, the same is my brother and sister and mother. Chapter 12, verse 50. Well, yes, but... Yet, to quote a contemporary discussion, Mary, also known as St. Mary the Virgin, the Blessed Virgin Mary, St. Mary, Mary Mother of God, or the Virgin Mary, is believed by many to be the greatest of all Christian saints. The Virgin Mother was, after her son, exalted by divine grace above all angels and men. She was not alone. She was not just the greatest. She was the greatest of a great many Christian saints. Most prominently, of course, were the great biblical saints, like St. Peter, St. Paul, and St. Stephen, the first Christian martyr. These belonged to everyone. Then there were the national saints. In England, above all others, was St. Thomas à Becket, who was murdered in 1170 by followers of King Henry II on the altar steps in Canterbury Cathedral. Also, there were regional saints, as well as those to whom one prayed for help on specific matters. St. Apollonia had all her teeth pulled out, or smashed when she was tortured for her faith. Naturally, it was to her that one turned with a toothache.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?